You're listening to Face Off, episode 59, recorded March 7th, 2010. Welcome to Face Off, your face-to-face web technology podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Jade Robbins.
And coming in via Skype this week is me, Mark Sanborn.
In this podcast, we talk about various aspects of web technology, such as web development, social media, and web entrepreneurship. As always, you can get our show notes by going to faceoffshow.com, and our show notes are always useful. We always love the show notes.
So this week I'm coming in from Skype because I kind of had a little head cold and I didn't want to get you and your wife sick. And
that's very kind of you.
Travel over to Bozeman, so.
But we are.
It's not a little easy.
Yeah, it gets a little fuzzy, and we might interrupt each other a little bit much because there's, you know, a couple millisecond delay. But that's life, right?
That is fine.
That's okay. See, I work on a college campus, so basically any disease that is in this town flows through my doors. So
you get used to it. That's not good. I remember living in the dorms and like you're sick all year round.
All right, so let's get into our news and follow-ups. We have a news item that's pretty cool. It's that GoDaddy is offering free SSL certificates for open source projects.
Yeah, I thought this was really cool because a lot of times, you know, so open source stuff, open source projects need SSL for, you know, setting up like a secure place to do Git pushes and pulls, or, you know, a place to get downloads. You're verified, you know, to get the downloads from their URL and things like that. And, you know, open source projects are oftentimes done by people that are, you know, they don't have a whole lot of money to contribute to the project and they just want to get an SSL. And I think it's really cool that GoDaddy has stepped up to the plate and they're saying, you know, if you are a verified open source project and have a website, you can get a free SSL certificate.
Yeah. I like these companies too that rather than, I mean, I like both models of, you know, directly contributing to open source, but I also like companies that are giving open source infrastructure. And that's kind of what this is. It's saying, you know, we're not giving money to just one open source project that we really care about, which is okay too. I mean, helping out open source in any way I think is great. But this is also like it's saying, hey, any open source, no matter what language, what you're doing, if it's an open source project, you can get an SSL and that, you know, sort of gives, you know, like they kind of say there when you go to the page, it gives, you know, a little bit more validity to your project. You have an SSL now, you're a real entity, it's something that's gonna happen.
Yeah, it's great. And you know, SSLs aren't too expensive. I think the cheaper ones are now, you know, $12 or something. Yeah. But it's just still, it's a way for them to say thank you for the open source guys.
Totally. So thank you, GoDaddy. Open source projects everywhere are happy to hear that, I'm sure. The next news item that we have is that Google is scoring their own search engine optimization.
Yeah, so, you know, Google has a lot of services, Google Analytics, Google Reader. They probably have 100 different, web apps that we've all talked about and you've probably used on a day-to-day basis.
Oh, yeah.
As you know, there's a lot of people that are interested in SEO and getting their websites to the top, or maybe even just getting their website in the search engine, period. And it's interesting. Google scored their own apps as if they kind of would. And this is the part that I think is really interesting is this is they have a deep understanding of their own algorithm. And so I would say that their scoring is biased towards what, you know, they actually look for when they're looking for,
you would think,
you know,
right?
A page that goes to the top. So, but the whole thing is a big giant and it's very, very detailed report on each of Google's services, at least, the major ones. And they score, you know, whether they have good SEO practices in place, and they don't always do. But what I think the really interesting thing to take out of this is what they are looking for SEO. This is like a single report with almost everything that you would need to know about SEO.
You know, this is funny. I'm looking at the report card, and one of the things is description meta tag use. And I thought I had heard somewhere that Google completely removed looking at meta tags.
Well, I think if I was reading it right, there was meta tags for different sections of the page or something. Oh. There might be something that I don't know too much about because I haven't done SEO in at least a year, and SEO moves so fast.
Yeah,
like this. Oh yeah, I remember this no ODB tag and some of these things I've known about, but yeah, it's really interesting.
Hmm.
That they score, and sometimes they score just terrible.
Yeah, they're not doing that great on some things, and that's it's cool that a company is honest enough like that to say, you know, this is, and it's also kind of fun to think that maybe they're not the, you know, the best source to go out there for, to look to see what you should do for SEO. I mean, people inside the company are the best source, like Matt Cutts, you know, are a good source to figure out what you should do, but maybe you shouldn't just go to google.com and look at what they do all the time to see if you're doing the right stuff.
Another thing that's interesting is it's like, it kind of, so they're showing where they rank in the search engine and things, and it kind of gives you the illusion, or maybe it's true, that they don't really manipulate the search to get their own pages to the top. A perfect example of that is down towards the bottom here, they do a video search, and the top video is a video of which they don't really want to, out there at the top. It's you know, it's kind of a video that's kind of not safe for work.
Racy.
And so it gives you the impression, at least, that Google is not really pushing their own stuff to the top. They're just like you and I, that have pages, and they have to get to the top just the way, you know, me and you do. Yeah.
Well, one good thing,
you know, go ahead.
I'm sorry. This is that delay we find. One thing that Google has done, like we've seen with the Nexus One, is they are big proponents of eating their own dog food. So, I mean, that makes sense that they wouldn't try and just push their stuff up artificially. The way Google and a lot of their projects, like their 20% projects, the way they do that is by using it. They come up with new features by using it and deciding what they need. So by being providers of people that are trying to get their results to the top because they have products that they want to get to the top of, you know, their SEO ranking, It also shows them maybe flaws in their systems or areas of improvement. So, I mean, I've always been one of those people. I didn't think they ever did that. They didn't seem like the company that would do that to me.
True. Yeah, so it's interesting anyways.
Yeah, it's really cool. I mean, like a lot of, you know, we talk about 301s before, and like a lot of the things they focus on is making sure that you 301 incorrectly.
And you know, it is something. That's true. And it is something to say that, you know, they could have just put all their products at the top of every search listing that has something to do with that space. But it's apparent that they're not really doing that. So
yeah,
it's pretty cool. And if you're interested in SEO, definitely check it out, because they talk about, you know, where they need to make improvements. And oftentimes the places they need to make improvements are also the places you need to make improvements.
Absolutely. That's a great point. So check out what Google's doing with their SEO report card. Pretty helpful. I was very intrigued by it. Let's get in to our geek tool of the week. So our geek tool this week is a Westinghouse LED light bulb. And there was one of these that was for sale on Amazon a while ago. I was going to put on the show, but it got such terrible reviews. But this one is different. It also has sort of the same problems as the other one, but its reviews seem to be more useful. People are saying, and so I guess what it is, it's a light bulb. It uses 3 watts. It's, you know, it has LEDs in it. It's such a small footprint of power. It's amazing. But they aren't as bright as a lot of your fluorescent bulbs, your compact fluorescents, or, you know, your typical regular light bulbs. They're just not as bright, and that's okay. But what I want to use these for, and this is why I put them as the geek tool, is you look at Lifehacker a lot. They have like these really cool workspace videos. And a lot of things that really can help a workspace is just ambient lighting. It's really amazing. I did it in my office. We had this old lamp that the power switch on it was broke, so it was on all the time anyways. And I put in a really, you know, a compact fluorescent bulb, which was energy efficient at the time. And I just stuck it behind my desk so that the light kind of shines up against the white wall behind my desk. I can turn the main light in the office off, and that ambient light is just enough. It makes it really relaxing. I can focus. It's not very bright and harsh. It, you know, it's a little bit dim. I need one more light in there.
But you can still see your keyboard and everything.
I can see my keyboard. It's very relaxing. I mean, often harsh lights, people really don't like them, and I'm one of those people. I like kind of a darker room. With, you know, some these ambient lights, it's not direct overhead light, so it's kind of lighting up the whole room on the sides. It's not like blinding you. So, you know, like you could take one of these bulbs, 3 watts. And so like that's, I'm going to replace the bulb I have in there now with this one, this 3 watts, because I leave it on 24/7. I like the ambient light all the time. I don't have to think about it. I just want it to be on. And this way I can use a ridiculously less amount of light of power for only $10. And this will last you 20 years.
Yeah, this is great. You know, I have to say, I'm looking at the Amazon page and they have some pictures, and that's really cool. It shows the differences between a regular CFL, like a 15-watt CFL, and a 3-watt LED. So you can kind of see the brightness. It is not going to be as bright. But that's just, I mean, if you know that, you can buy it for situations where you don't need it, like that bright, like, you know, ambient light for your desk. I'm thinking out of my porch, I have two floodlights right now that I just don't even use that light anymore because it just lights up that porch like just ridiculous. And one of these would be great. I might even leave it on, you know, most of the night or something if I could keep it that. And then the other benefit of LEDs is they pretty much last forever. It had like a, what was it, 25,000 hour lifespan or something.
And, most people assume that you can buy LED lighting and it'll last you 20 years. It's sort of the sort of average use case. So,
and 3 watts, that's, I mean...
Yeah,
that's cool.
So, like, one of these pictures on the Amazon thing is a nightstand. It's a light next to your bed. You know, that's, you don't need a really bright light next to your bed, especially like for me. I am always going to bed later than my wife, so it would be nice to actually have a dimmer light in my nightstand light so I can go in. And then another thing, these are shaped like normal light bulbs, so that if you do have a lamp with like the shade on top of it where it clips onto the bulb and stuff, it will still fit. It's not like sometimes you get those CFLs that have the sort of curly fluorescent tube inside and you can't use your regular lamp shades with them because the lamp shades are sort of designed to pop over the sort of bulb top shape of the bulb.
Cool. So
check it out. $10. And I think I'm going to spend a little bit of money to get a couple of these puppies because I just like ambient lights. And there's some of them that I just like on all the time. I don't like to think about it. Same with my porch light. I like to keep my porch light on all the time because the second you leave your house and forget to turn your porch light on, you know, and come back, you're like, oh, man. So for me, it's just easier to leave it on all the time. And with these bulbs, they use just a minuscule amount of power. So it's great.
Yeah, after looking at this picture on Amazon for, you know, they're using it as a porch light. I think my situation is perfect because the lights I have right now are just way too bright.
They really light it up, that's for sure. Two big halogen flood
lights. That is actually cool. I think I might get one of these, and then like you said, I mean, if you don't really worry about it leaving it on all night because it's only 3 watts.
Totally. All right, let's get into our web apps this week. Our first web app is Post Parrot.
So I thought Post Parrot was pretty cool. Basically, it's just a URL that, you know, postparrot.com. You can browse to it in a browser and see, you know, a little bit about it. Or you can actually just send your post data through it. Yeah. So like if you're developing a form and for some reason your form, you know, data is not coming through right, or, you know, you want to see what's kind of going on, you can just send it to postparrot.com. So this is, you know, like form method action. Equals, you know, the action equals, all you would do is specify postparrot.com there and you would see all the post data.
Yeah. So we've talked about the we've talked about the restful verbs before, right? Which is like get, post, put, and delete, I think. I can remember there isn't. But get and post are sort of the big ones that we use in the web. So like delete and I can't remember
what Isn't get and post the only ones, and put is just a special way of doing a post?
Maybe. Yeah, I can never remember my restful verbs, which is sad because there's only four of them. But most major browsers only really support natively get and post. So get is like when you go to a web page and you're just getting the contents of that. You're like, get, okay. Post is when you're – see, the difference is there's like post – there's one that creates a new thing and then one that updates an existing one. And I can't remember which one's which. So, but the get and post are the two that most major browsers handle. So, in a post is when you send a form and you're sending it over the, you know, post data using a post restful call. So most forms use that. You know, the cool part about this is there are some things. So like in Rails, you know, let's say it's easy for me to just say, you know, print the params, which is the hash of all the post and get variables. That's okay, but this one even has some more information, like it has your user agent and things like that, and it cleans it up nice, and it, you know, it's pretty cool, just a little simple website. It makes it easy for you to see what post information you're sending across.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, now, you know, there's other ways to do this as well. I know Rails and some of these frameworks, PHP frameworks and things, will actually show you the post data in the server, like, console, and, you know, if there's an error on the page, it usually will dump out, you know, the post data. And then a lot of people use a Firefox extension that does a similar thing to this, and that is the HTTP live headers. And we'll put a link to that, but it can also show you like the get and post request stuff. It's mainly for like a Java. Well, it can be used the same way as this, but also like
most people use it for JavaScript.
JavaScript thing where when you click on a button, it goes and does a GET request or something, and you want to know what's going on. That's, I mean, very helpful. But this one, I like this one just because it was really simple. And if you don't have that live headers installed, or you're working in Chrome or Internet Explorer or something where you're doing some testing and you just want to do something real quick, this PostPirate is pretty cool. And that's about it. I mean, it's really simple.
Yeah. Yeah. So check it out. Let's get on to our next web app, which is one I want to talk about. I'm excited about this. It's called Fave4, and you can get to it by going to fave4.org. And what Fave4 is just, it's a really dead simple start page. So when you open up your web page, like in Firefox, by default, it takes you to the Firefox Google search. In Chrome, there's sort of which I believe they kind of stole from Opera, a dial pad sort of thing where it shows the most recent sort of tabs you've had or your most useful. And like I, for the longest time, I used iGoogle as a homepage and stuff. But Fave4 is just dead simple. I really like it. There's no login. It's all cookie-based. So I go there, and what I do is I can set it up myself, and it's just it just has four big squares in the middle that look really pretty, four big icons, and you can set like your favorite four websites that you want to be on your Fave4 homepage. So for me, I set it to like iGoogle, Gmail, Facebook, and Twitter. Those are sort of the ones that I usually go and need a quick bookmark to, I go to the most. And then there's other things you can do, which is cool. You can set it up and customize it a little bit, and it just saves it all in the cookies for you so that, you know, you don't have to log in, which is nice because you get tired of giving login information to every website out there. You can do things like give it a black background. You can put a search bar on it, and then you can tell it which search engine you want to be your default search engine for that web page. So like if you really like Bing, you can have your Fave4 search go to Bing or Google. And it's just really, it's dead simple. You go in and mess around with it, and it's really nice and pretty.
Yeah, when you're saying it's simple, you mean it. I mean, there's four boxes, and they take up, you know, a third of the screen. And, you know, those are the four things. I mean, a lot of times, yeah, like you said, Gmail and you know, iGoogle or whatever. These are apps that you're probably going to, you know, when you start up your browser in the morning and you're drinking your coffee and you're getting going, you want to go check your email and stuff. And why not have this, you know, as your homepage and just, you know, click on the email button, read your email, and open up a new tab and click on the next button and check it out. I mean, it's really simple. And like you said, it's really nice. You don't have to log in. It's all cookie-based. So there's no switching cost in this. I mean, this is easy.
Yeah.
There's you can try it without, you know, risking anything, really.
Totally. Yeah, you don't have to risk anything. And it's, well, I guess so, sort of as a funny side note, or I mean just a discussion, that you don't really use a start page, though, do you?
I don't. I don't know why. I guess I don't even use the Chrome built-in one that, you know,
really?
Like you
so
said.
You just do like an about.blank or whatever, about:blank or.
Well, I mean, I have it there as my default, but like I don't ever look at those things and say, oh, I'm going to click there and go to it. Because like right now I just open a new tab and I don't see Gmail in my top four, which it definitely should be. I must have hit like the X button on it for some reason. Maybe this is why, because I do have multiple Gmail accounts. I also have Google Apps, which are run through Gmail, so they're going to look exactly the same.
Mm-hmm.
I do see one. So it does show so like if it is a Google app, like you know, my company LLC, it will show that in the bottom there. So they do have a way to distinguish multiple Gmail type accounts, but I think that was one of the reasons why I didn't get into it, and I don't know.
Well, and something funny too is like the Chrome start page, it takes a screenshot, and sometimes it's hard to discern websites from just a screenshot, because a lot of them, unless you are going to some really nice designed websites, I mean, a lot of basic websites like Facebook and Google and stuff just really aren't super discernible. They are, but not as discernible as four giant icons in the middle of the page, you know?
That's true.
You definitely know there's between Facebook and Twitter and Gmail on Fave4.
I'm noticing in Chrome, though, they do have a list view where you can just get rid of the thumbnails and kind of see that way, and that looks pretty cool. I can distinguish them a little bit easier. But like you said, there's nothing easier than four big giant icons and nothing else. No, like, screenshot.
The one thing is, being it is cookie-based, there are pros and cons to that. So I have to go and set it up on all of my computers, on all of my browsers, rather than just being able to go to Fave4 with having my session data and doing it. That's okay.
That's true.
Either way, it would be nice if they did either way, where I could log in and get my stuff, or I could just do cookie-based without login, but whatever.
One advantage of Chrome's as well is it's dynamic. So if you start going to this other page, if you start going to Yahoo Mail instead of Gmail, it'll just automatically switch for you. Totally. You don't have to go configure it, but yeah. I don't know. I don't know why I haven't been a big fan of start pages, but I haven't. Maybe I like to type more than I just like to say gmail.com. I don't know.
That's true.
I'm inefficient, I guess.
You are horribly inefficient. If you have some news, a follow-up, or web application you think we should look at on the show, let us know by going to faceoffshow.com/feedback. You can send us email or tweet us out. We love hearing from you guys, which actually, our topic this week is from an email. We had Brian Barthold, who emailed us, and he says, "Hello, Jada Mark. I just wanted to say that I love the show. I really appreciate the fact that you guys cover some great topics that I rarely hear elsewhere on any podcast. I would like to know if you could show or maybe do a how-to guide on source code management. We use Dreamweaver where I work, and I know they allow Subversion. I would really like to use SCM, but I fear that some coworkers are afraid of the command line or don't see the value of an extra effort required to make a commit. Any suggestions or ideas? Keep up the good work. I will be listening. Thanks, Brian." So this is a big problem, right?
I mean, I think most people that you described, you know, revision control to, I think they understand the benefits. But, I mean, there are a lot of people that are afraid of the command line. And sometimes it's like, well, can we just get going on the project? I mean, this takes some time to do these commit things, you know? And
yeah.
So, I mean, I'm a single developer, and I absolutely wouldn't even dream of doing a project without revision control anymore.
Totally. I agree.
And we're going to talk about these signs that there's no version control in place. I used to have a method of keeping backups and things. But I am now, and this is, I think at least 2 years ago now, when I started revision control, and I just, you know, knowing what I know now, I will just never use, or I will just never make another project without it.
Yeah.
And I'm a single developer. Like I don't even fit the, you know, most people that come to revision control are people that are working with multiple developers.
Well,
in your case,
I would say that if you're working with multiple developers, this is the most essential tool to have, because there is nothing worse than trying to share a folder or something and your work gets overwritten by a coworker because they FTP up after you without pulling down first. And the funny part is Dreamweaver has like the capability to do this for you, to try and do like this sort of FTP revision control using, it's just terrible. I've done this before. I worked in an environment where we didn't use this, and it was like, oh, well, I just uploaded my work. And he's like, well, did you download like 2 seconds ago before you did it? And you're like, ugh. And I mean,
you know,
really,
go ahead.
I mean, just the whole point of revision control is that there should be no work lost. Everything is recorded in some way.
Yeah, and I was going to say about that Dreamweaver one, it only works if everyone's using Dreamweaver. If somebody in your area is using NetBeans or, you know, a text editor or Notepad 2 or, you know, whatever, it's not going to work. Whereas some of these other source code management, it doesn't care what you use. It'll still work.
Okay, so like, what are some signs? I mean, these are kind of funny because we all did it. What are some signs that you're not using, you know, a revision control system?
Some of them, you know, working on a live server and doing stuff like, you know, index.html.backup or back and or like, you know, this is even worse where, you know, you start having index.html.old and then you put like a date on it, you know, February 1st, 2007 or something. You have like 10 of them in there.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, by doing that, you are, you know, in a fundamental way, you're making yourself, you're doing revision control.
Absolutely, yeah.
You might as well just have a program that's better at doing it.
Yeah, for
you.
A lot better.
These are the signs that, you know, no revision control system is in place. You know, multiple copies of entire directories, you know, like, you know, project X, backup, and then like a date, and, you know, making entire backups of your project at different states, you know. The hesitation to make code changes. A lot of times, you know, you're looking at the code and you're like, well, I got to be careful here because if I screw something up, I won't be able to go back to where I was. Mm-hmm. And so what a lot of times what they'll do to eliminate some of this hesitation is they'll actually just make a new folder called, you know, the project original or something. And then they'll go take that and then they'll go into the project, make some changes. Totally. And if they do screw it up, they'll delete that folder and go back to the original. Mm-hmm. So, So these are some of the signs here. And, you know, lost work. And this is a big one. Lost work when a coworker overwrites your changes.
So let's say, on this. I mean, even if you're not using FTP, let's say you have a shared folder. Let's say you write this really good chunk of code. And your coworker comes in and he just says, even though, you know, you're not using FTP syncing or anything like that, he just goes in and he's like, I don't think that method's right, and deletes it, saves the file, and then starts writing his own. And then halfway through it goes, oh man, they're not doing the FTP roundup there, you know, like the little FTP goofiness, that's still lost work. You can't get that back, right? Your good code is gone.
Yeah, unless you make another folder somewhere with a date. The problem is you end up with like 100 different folders and all these things, and it becomes a big mess. And, you know, another one to get around what we were talking about is sometimes these small groups will designate one person to kind of be the changer.
Yeah.
You know, they give gatekeeper. Me all your changes and I'll make sure that it's, you know, in here. That's just, it's kind of inefficient.
Yeah.
And these problems right here that are really common, you know, I've done them. I used to do all these.
Yeah, me too.
This is what revision control was made for.
Yeah.
And if you're looking around and you do some of these things, you need to get revision control.
Yeah. So he's working and I'm not sure. It's kind of unclear. He says that I know that they allow subversion. And I'm not sure if that means that Dreamweaver allows subversion or they allow subversion at work. But I think subversion is a good place to start. Don't you think?
Subversion is a really simple model. You know, you have a central place where you store the code and everybody kind of commits to it and they check out the new revisions from it. It's really simple.
Yeah.
Right. I wouldn't be opposed, even though, you know, all the hype is Git and Mercurial and these distributed source code management systems, I wouldn't be opposed to recommending Subversion.
Yeah,
for a beginner.
Exactly. I consider the big three for me when it comes to revision control. It's Subversion, Git, and HG, which is Mercurial. Those are the three that I would not hesitate to use. Any other, I'm sure there are others out there that are just as good, but these, I think those three are sort of the most popular among developers doing the web. And those are the ones I would not hesitate to recommend to anybody. Like Mark said, Subversion is a simpler model. So if you're trying to not confuse people, but really, I mean, so like the best thing you can do though is to learn them yourself, right? I mean, that's a great tip, is if you're trying to get your coworkers to do it, you really should learn it yourself. Which is sort of the beauty of like Git and Mercurial is that they're distributed. You don't have to have a server or anything to use them. You can just use them yourself.
Yep. You don't need to, you know, set up a centralized server. You can just do it locally on your own computer. You know, and some of the, let's say you're the only, we kind of talked about this before the show. Let's say you're the only developer that is using the version control. And then, you know, your other coworkers will just kind of submit code as they go. At least you can keep track of your own code and their code.
Yeah, exactly. You know that you can sit and work and say, I got this chunk done. I'm going to commit this. And then, you know, even if they have no clue that you're using Git or Mercurial in this project, they can go and make their changes. And next time you go in to do your work, you can commit and just make a commit that says, this was all their changes since last I touched it. And at least that way you're covering your own butt, so to say. You know, you're like, you're using the tool the way it should. No one else can. And that's sort of the beauty of Git and Mercurial, is that it's really easy for a single developer to use, whether or not they're developing with other people. I mean, if, as long as it's a shared folder and you send that .git or that .hg folder along with the code whenever they get it, then that's okay. Then it's smart enough to figure it out for you.
Yeah, so if you're looking for a place to start, I would say, you know, learn it yourself and just use it in anywhere you can. And then... You know, when you have a good point to, you know, you think you've got it down, or maybe you've got a good example. Let's say you edited some stuff and it wasn't working, and you got a really good example. You can kind of pick an employee to, you know, one of your coworkers to show and say, look, I've been using this system for a while, and I kind of made a mistake, or you guys did. And look how we can easily just look at what happened before, or we can revert back to this changes and kind of show them and maybe guide them and show them how to use it. And that kind of does two things. It shows the benefit of it, and it also helps get that other employee.
Yeah, it shows that you're confident in it and that it's useful. Also, it's like, you know, the truth is, I think with a lot of people, once you fully understand revision control. I mean, once you understand it, not just using it, but you understand it, you're going to say, how did I ever code without this? I mean, go up to your coworker and say, are you one of those people that has to leave the same program open all the time so that you can like control Z to undo back any changes you do, you know? And they're gonna be like, yeah. And it's like, well, there you go. You know, how about you just, you make a change, save it, commit it. There you go. It can roll back for you. It can do all kinds of stuff. And really try and show them how you can use it and how it'll save them time. Because a developer, if they think their system is perfect already, then it's going to be hard to really show them the benefits of it until you show them that, you know, if I take 30 seconds after I fully finish a feature to go in and commit it, then I won't have to worry about that time where I have to spend a half an hour reconstructing my code when something goes wrong or I went down a path. Like branching is another one. You know, instead of having to create another folder and having to do all this funky stuff and then, you know, if it works, trying to merge it back in manually. I mean, you're doing a lot of these workflows already. There's just not a tool to make it easier to do it for you. So, you know. Yeah.
I think one of the points we hit on here was that you don't need to get like everybody on your team to jump on board all at once. You can start with yourself and then maybe, you know, spread out and teach another employee, teach another coworker, and eventually you'll get everybody to use it. And then you'll really understand the benefits. Maybe you'll set up like a bug tracker or something and each person will take, you know, features at a time and commit those. But he had some hesitation about the command line. He was thinking maybe his coworkers be, you know, a little bit afraid of it. Maybe they haven't been exposed to it as much. Is there any tool? I mean, can we help them out with that?
That's excellent because you know what? There is tons of, or not tons, but there are plenty of GUI tools out there so that you can use revision control without ever having to use the command line. Some of them that I've seen people use before is sort of I call them like the Tortoise suite because they have them for a lot of them. But there's like Tortoise SVN, Tortoise HG, Tortoise Git, Tortoise CVS even. I mean, they're Tortoise Bazaar. And what those do is they're like shell extensions for Windows. So if you're programming in Windows, they're like these little things so that you can go into Explorer and you go to a folder and you can right click and say, you know, init or, you know, initialize a Git repository in here, and it's all done through right-clicking through the Explorer interface so that there's no special program or anything like that, and you can go into that folder, and then it, you know, it pops up stuff as you are doing it, but it's right there natively in the system that you're used to using already.
Yeah, and, you know, we like to research some of these things. I'm typically a command line kind of guy. I kind of develop in Linux, and so I haven't been exposed to too much for the GUI stuff. But we don't like to recommend things that we don't try out on the show. So I went ahead and installed Tortoise HG, and I played around with it for a while. And I have to say, it is really great. I mean, it can do everything that I normally do. And it also it's kind of nice. It shows color diffs, and it allows you to do some really cool things. And it was really easy to install on Windows. It comes with Mercurial, so you don't even have to worry about installing Python or any of that stuff. It just installs everything for you. Mm-hmm. And that's the Mercurial side. I'm sure the Git one is just as easy for Tortoise. Yeah. I hadn't tried that one, but they're you know, pretty much the same.
Yeah.
So, like you said, it's a suite of products. So definitely, if you think they might be afraid of the command line, have them check out Tortoise HG or you yourself go ahead and try that first.
Yeah, exactly. And then there's really, it's funny that there's apprehension to that, but it makes it a lot easier for people. I know a lot of people who are definitely not console guys who are working in Windows who really how we convinced them to start using source code management was to install Tortoise and say, look, it's really not that hard. Now you just need to learn the workflow. You don't really need to learn the commands, which is kind of the hump over if you're learning on the console. You have that sort of dual, you know, junk of having to learn the workflow and the commands. And then, you know, now I know they're, even though I don't think they've ever used it in the console since, you know, for 2 years now, but they still really, you know, they have to have revision control, and it's really helpful.
Yeah. That's the value, is the revision control. It doesn't matter if they use a GUI or command.
Yeah, exactly. and it's for the better of your team too, then.
Definitely. The other thing you can do is, you know, get them excited about Git. Linus Torvalds, the creator of Git and also the Linux kernel, gave an hour-long talk to Google employees describing how great it was. And he even said SVN was a pointless open source project. Take some of his things with a grain of salt. He likes to...
He's got a little biased, right?
But like, it's a really interesting talk, and he, you know, he goes in there and he talks a lot about revision control, and I mean, you can tell by the way he talks, he wouldn't even dream of doing the Linux kernel without. I mean, they couldn't. They couldn't.
Oh,
even,
you can't.
They couldn't.
Yeah.
You know, Dig.com uses Git. Facebook uses Git. MailChimp, which is a cool service. Web, you know, they do. And all these ones are web. You know, I chose these ones because they're web kind of sites. You know,
big web
project. Not just like a big soft, not like Linux kernel or some big software deal. So MailChimp uses Mercurial or HG. And the other thing is, I'm going to link to a Stack Overflow discussion.
This is kind hilarious. Of
something to get you excited. The question on Stack Overflow is, you know, what are some of the reasons not to use a revision control system? Mm-hmm. And the first answer got 565 upvotes, and the answer was there is no good reasons not to use a version control, so not even one. And it's interesting to look mm-hmm. at this and kind of get excited because there's a lot of people in there. I mean, the Stack Overflow is a programmer's question and answer site, and so. You know, these programmers are in there and they're like, you know, what? No, you have to use a revision control system. One of the other answers was, you know, the sense of danger gives me a programming or gives my programming an edge. Yeah. You know,
not using a revision control system. You know, I'm living on the edge. I like the danger.
Another funny one was you hate your company and you want to see them fail. Like that. It's evident by the hundreds and hundreds of programmers in here that they just wouldn't even think of not using version control.
It absolutely is a best practice.
If you want to kind of get excited and or maybe get your coworkers excited about the idea of revision control, maybe show them one of these posts that most programmers use it.
Yeah.
And then, you know, to answer the end of your question where you asked maybe is there any like how-to guides? I found a few and we're going to link to these. HG has a great, like working with HG and we're going to link with that if you want to go that route. I also have an installer here that's going to help you install it on Windows because I'm going to assume some of your coworkers are going to be on Windows. And then a cheat sheet for both Mercurial and Git.
And I also found an article on how to link up Subversion and Dreamweaver, which is what I think you were talking about in your mail, Brian. Which, again, I can't say that I love Subversion anymore now that I've learned Git and Mercurial, but really Subversion is better than nothing. It's what I started with. And if, you know, if it takes integration with Dreamweaver, which is your IDE, then that's cool. That's better than nothing. You need to use that. And this is a link on how to set it up and get it used.
And one of the reasons we answered this mailbag question publicly as a podcast is I don't think Brian is the only one with this issue. I think a lot of people are hesitant to it, but I think once they get onto it, I've never heard of anybody that's ever used one and said, "Oh, I don't think I'd use it anymore."
Yeah, you know, I mean, once they understand it, and if you're a programmer, you really realize that this does make your life easier. And it seems like it's so funny when you first start. It seems like a lot of overhead to commit. You're like, "Okay, I got to commit my files and write a commit message." Man, commit message, and it seems like a lot, but I tell you now that, I mean, it's nothing. That is nothing. I do git commit dash m with a tiny message probably, you know, 100 times a day, just because once you finish a chunk of functionality, you want that recorded and you want to be able to, you know, the more you segment these sort of chunks of functionality and commit, then, you know, the better it is and more useful the tool is for you in the end. So
I was going to ask you, how long do you think you spend doing a commit? Like how many seconds?
Oh, five, maybe
25 seconds or something. Yeah. Maybe
it depends. Like, so there, let's get into some advanced stuff. There are some really cool stuff you can do with Git and HG. It's like staging commits. So I learned this from my coworker Robbie Lamb at work. He's really into Git. If you use their GUI, so there's a built-in Git GUI called Git GUI, and then there's also one for OS X called GitX, which is basically a really prettier version of Git GUI. And you can do these sort of things. So like instead of having to commit after every time you finish a bunch of work, we work and work and work and work and work, you know, for a while. And then we do this cool thing where you can pull up like the Git GUI and you can stage certain lines to a commit. So, you know, instead of making just one really big commit that's like, I worked on a whole bunch of different stuff, I can go in with this GUI really easily and say like this line and this line from this file, this line and this line and this line from this file are for working on the user authentication system. It'll make that commit with just those lines I selected. And then I can go and look at the other files and say, okay, this line, and this line, this line, this line are, you know, refactoring this section.
I'm glad you brought that up because actually, you know, we talked about Brian committing everybody else's changes as one giant commit. technically he could go through there and kind of look at the different features other programmers added. It would be extra burden on him, but it might be worth it to just to start out.
Then he could show his coworkers on that. Like, I went through your last bit of work, and I went through each line and found functionality and committed them the way they should have been. And so now look at this. Let's say this last commit of work that you did wasn't good. I can revert one version back and then and refactor it. Or look, you broke it somewhere between this commit and this commit. It was broken, so I can go back to this commit before, look at the difference between those two, because that's a tool. You can look at the difference between files during revisions and see what was actually edited between the two and figure out where the bad code is. Super useful. Brian, we wish you the best of luck. I hope you can get your coworkers onto this, because we think it's awesome, and I think you'll think it's awesome once you really get into it, and hopefully you can show them the benefit of it, because if you're a programmer, you need to be using it. So thank you for the question, Brian. We appreciate it. That about wraps it up for this episode of Face Off. We want to remind you can subscribe to the show by going to faceoffshow.com/subscribe, and you can also leave feedback for the show by going to faceoffshow.com/feedback. We'd love to hear from you guys. Questions, anything like Brian's question here, we really appreciate it, and we will see you guys next week.